Hey, quick reminder right before we get into the show, FC Insiders, our newsletter that comes out every Wednesday at 2 p.m., just relaunched, and we are talking about insights and information that will help you shape the future of your brand. We're not so much about predicting the future as we are about giving you tools to shape your future. And those tools are being talked about in media companies like Forbes, Forrester, and NBC Universal, who are saying that we at Future Commerce are helping brands make decisions that shape the future of retail as we know it. You can get those types of insights right now at FC Insiders newsletter, and you can sign up on that list right now at futurecommerce.fm. Let's get to the show. Future Commerce is brought to you by Vertex. Vertex is the leader of tax technology solutions and services for corporations worldwide. They're trusted by over half of the Fortune 500. Vertex Cloud meets sales and use tax solutions for businesses of all kinds. Visit them online today at vertexsmb.com. Future Commerce is brought to you by Gladly. What if customer service could feel like a conversation between friends? Gladly is the customer service platform that puts people at the center, not tickets or cases. By enabling B2C companies to focus on people talking to people, Gladly powers a lifetime of conversions across every channel from phone, email, text, chat, and social media. See what a truly customer-centered platform looks like at gladly.com/FC demo. That's gladly.com/FC, as in Future Commerce, demo. Future Commerce is brought to you by Klaviyo, whose customers have made more than $3.7 billion in revenue through Klaviyo's marketing platform in the last year alone. Choose to own your brand's growth with personalized marketing. Visit klaviyo.com/futurecommerce to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about cutting edge and next generation commerce. I'm Brian.
And I'm Philip. And today we have with us the co-founder of The Grommet, Jules Pieri. Say hello, Jules.
Hey, glad to be here.
All right, glad to have you. We met a few months ago when I was at the Adobe's Magento Imagine conference and you spoke, and I was just so I was rapt by your story and your founder story of The Grommet, and just felt like you connected so well at that show. I said I had to meet you. You've been so gracious over the last few months as we've worked out the details here. But I have to confess, up until that show, I had never heard of The Grommet, but I had definitely seen products that were launched through The Grommet. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what is The Grommet?
Yeah, sure. I'll start with The Grommet, I guess. I started the company 11 years ago, and we launch one consumer product a day. These are innovative products from small businesses. So the ones that you might be referencing, Phil, that people know we launched or that came from us are SodaStream or Fitbit, Idea Paint, Bananagrams, OtterBox, Mrs. Myers. A lot of products that we launched many, many years ago have become household names. And I started the business because I saw the opportunity essentially as technology made it easier for individuals to create products, i.e. small businesses. The internet, 3D printing, all kinds of things made it easier. The larger companies were less and less innovative, more and more kind of defending their legacy products because they were under a lot of pressure at retail and still are. As retail became more consolidated, retailers got more power to squeeze suppliers. Mm. Everybody kind of tried to be their version of Walmart with discounting. So innovation for big companies was really threatened, and the little guys stepped into the breach, and I thought they needed a friend. Like, that's all great if they have a wonderful product, but it's really hard to take something to market and find an audience. So that's what we did. We have almost 4 million people who pay attention to what we launch every day.
Wow.
And that's really powerful.
Wow. Really powerful.
and not a short-lived story. 11 years, you said?
Yeah. The first 4 years were a walk in the wilderness, though. Like, we were like laying down tracks for who we were and quality of product and quality of storytelling. The business was anemic. We had no resources and it was the economic crisis. So while I would never want to relive that time period again, it did have benefit of sort of doing things the old fashioned hard way of like knowing what made us distinctive and investing really heavily in that, you know, great products, great stories, great companies.
Yeah, no, I think looking back at that period, it was just, you had to be good. You had to like focus on what was, what set you apart in a way that maybe you don't have to today. So it's no surprise. Yeah. It's no surprise that you became what you became. You know, the businesses that made it out of that period had to do a really good job. So congratulations.
Really battle hardened. I was looking at a list of questions that I'm going to address tomorrow in a team meeting. We have, you know, an Ask Me Anything, and the questions are submitted ahead of time. And one of them was about, hey, there's some concern of a pending recession. And not that I would welcome that, but I was like, oh my God, do you think that scares me? Come on.
A little bit. Through that before. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of grit. What's your backstory? How did you end up founding the Grommet and you know, have that, you know, ability to pull on through like you did?
Well, I guess the grit part of my story is probably the part that mattered the most. You're pretty kind of have a lot of perspective there to recognize that. And I grew up kind of the wrong side of the tracks in Detroit, first person in my family to go to college. And the most entrepreneurial like starter thing I did was when I was 14, I snuck behind my parents' backs and applied to boarding school. Not because I wanted to get away from them. I just was tired of the chairs flying over my head in the Detroit public schools. Detroit was really suffering in the education department. So I just kind of very early started developing kind of a playbook for doing things that were scary and uncomfortable for myself. And I learned to like it. Like now I don't like it when I am comfortable. So that's a really good kind of platform for being an entrepreneur. My career itself spanned, I'd say, three different things. Early career, I was an industrial designer. So that's still my first love. I think that's, you know, business has become kind of my craft, if you will, but design's my passion or my love. Second thing I did was work for two other startups before I started the Grommet. I was the only person, well, I was the first designer to go to Harvard Business School, but the only person in my class to join a startup. And that company is still thriving. It's called Continuum, an innovation consultancy. And then I did a bunch of big company stuff and mainly working for Meg Whitman. She was a great boss. I worked for her directly at Keds, StrideRight, and Play School. And at Play School is where I really thought of the idea or I identified the need for the Grommet. I didn't do anything about it for years because this was actually in the late 90s. But that's when that retail squeeze on innovation started happening. And at Play School, our best new product ideas never made it to market. And that made no sense to me. And Meg told me, look, we're losing all the little guys, the independents who take risks on new products. So today, at this time, at that time back then, if Kmart, Target, Toys R Us, or Walmart don't want it, we can't make it. So that was like the little pissed off flame in my brain, you know, like that's just wrong that even a big company can't get things to market, much less little guys. But then my second startup was a social network, a professional one that competed with LinkedIn. It didn't win. We were sold to reputation.com, but you've never heard of Zigs. But I learned a lot. I was a pioneer in social media. And that's when the two things collided. After Zigs, I realized I understand the power of community. I know how to build them. I can figure out this media thing, which I didn't know anything about. Like we make a video every day. And if I could just jump over those four toy buyers and go straight to the people with that might be interested with a very short sort of introduction to this product, we could actually move markets. We could be a launch platform for products. So that's what we did.
I find it very interesting that it's the second time Meg Whitman's come up on the show in the last month. We recently had Jeremy King, who formerly worked with Meg at eBay, referenced her dedication to actually knowing who the customer is and forming relationships, you know, tasking folks with 10 customers to have to, you know, discuss and have real life conversations with in a quarter. That sounds really interesting.
That I helped her get there because we did a lot of that when I worked for her at Ked Stradre and at Play School. And that was one of my, you know, my disciplines as a designer. That's what you do in order to figure out what to design. So I was really comfortable in both doing that work directly and drawing conclusions from it. And also in a big company, you tend to commission a lot of that work. But I was the person who, when there was a one-on-one interview or a focus group, I was always behind that mirror. I was always reading the transcripts because that was kind of my superpower of knowing what to do with all that information. So she gave me a lot of credit for that at the time. She was way better trained than I was, but we kind of, so in terms of, she came from consulting early in her career. So she taught me a lot about how to structure projects and how to allocate resources and how to ask the right questions within a company to get the right solutions. But that kind of straight to the customer part was where I was adding a lot, I think.
You talked a bit about sort of this idea that you put a lot of effort into something that doesn't make it to market. I heard recently a podcast with Malcolm Gladwell who, you know, talked similarly with Rick Rubin, a famous musician producer, about a similar challenge in that like there's artistry and there's a lot left on the cutting room floor as a musician, right? The things that get released are only the best of the best of the best. And, but as a writer, you know, as a journalist, everything you do has to make it to market or it's a failure. And I find there's a really interesting place to be. I was wondering if maybe you could talk about how that artistry or curation or your background and influence in that having had that experience helps shape what you do with other entrepreneurs nowadays.
Well, I do think larger entities do have the option to play a little closer to the musician end of the spectrum where a lot ends up on the cutting floor. You know, their survival is threatened over the long haul, but not in the short haul if they kill a lot of projects. But the little guys we work with don't have that luxury. They're closer to your journalist spectrum in that they generally have a lot of advantages in terms of innovating products, but they tend to be really capital constrained. So they can't, you know, go out with a lot of failure products and you know, they pretty much have to get close to the target early on. In their company life cycle, or they won't make it unless they're deeply capitalized, which is pretty rare.
I think it's really interesting. You know, you talked about what you experienced back at Play School, and I think this is still a big problem, a big trend today. There's a lot of really great stuff that's not getting to market, and I love that the Grommets, you know, here as an option for people to launch products and. There are more and more ways to launch products, but I was just thinking back to an interview we did with Sucharita Kadali from Forrester. She described her experience at Toys R Us, and it's just exactly what you described in terms of how the purchasing cycle worked, why those better, more desirable, more innovative products never made it to the floor of a Toys R Us. It's still happening today. It's still a big problem. And so it's really exciting to see things like, you know, places like the Grommet grow. One thing that I saw, you know, that you've kind of coined recently is a term called citizen commerce. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So what that means to us is every act that a person takes to vote with either their time or their money to support businesses. And usually businesses have products. And we control as consumers 66% of the economy. And so, and we don't walk around really sort of realizing that or feeling the power of that, but it's absolutely true, especially today, right now. This is the consumers are completely driving the growth and the positive economic environment we're in right now. And what I like to think of citizen commerce as is a call to action to sort of recognize, well, okay, if we have this power, let's use it well and direct all that time and money to companies that we want to see shape the world, that have the values that, you know, every individual has different values. So if you're, let me make this precise. If you really care about the environment, or you really care about products being made in the USA, or you really care about products that have lifetime guarantees, or products that come from, say, a veteran or underrepresented minority, you have the opportunity to make that happen in the world, that those values get supported so easily by just being a little bit more intentional about where you spend your time and money. And I like to boil it down even to, like, just think about it for 10% of your budget, because it's not realistic to take 100% of your budget and very carefully evaluate your values against what you're doing. You're going to buy a car from a big company that may not represent a lot of the values you would otherwise like to uphold. So 10%, take 10%. And there are other companies, not just Agrama, who helps you do this, and other entities. I think the crowdfunding platforms are a great way of expressing that kind of thing. I think how you share and what you share on social media within your own world is a great way of acting on those things too. So it's not all about, like, going to a company and buying something. It's about saying, here are my values, and here's how I'm backing them up.
Mm. Making those choices, and, you know, sort of consistently in small ways.
Yes.
It really resonates with something, you know, that seems to be a current unintentional but welcome narrative that is playing out on our show, which is that consumers' demands, like consumers' expectations of brands, have become heightened, and they can wield power to sort of create winners and losers in the marketplace based on the values that you espouse as a brand. And the way that consumers can direct the future of our world could be by determining that they just don't want to engage with brands that don't have the values that they possess anymore. And I think what you're saying is that you've done with the Grommet is you're enabling consumers to use their voice to choose which brands and which products make it to the marketplace to begin with.
Yes, we meet these companies really early, and you know, are quite often the first big event in the company's history in terms of exposure. And we give them a lot of credibility, and they're borrowing our reputation when we do launch a product, because we're careful about who they are. We only launch 3% of what we see. We see 200 to 300 products a week, and we launch 6. So they get a huge leg up from us, but we're also trying to make it really easy for our community, because as much as many people aspire to the things we just said, it takes a lot of time to figure all this stuff out and figure out who's telling you the truth and what companies really stand for. And we just cut to the chase. We make that, you know, we do all that work. We have 92 people, you know, so we're helping people out with that activity. We don't want this to become like your second job to figure all this stuff out. We do that job for people.
But how do you help a company? Like, what is your role in actually making products reality, launching it on the platform? And then is there a role that you have in helping them transcend from, you know, a product or a single product company into a brand?
Great question. So we engage deeply when a company is in production or about to be in production. So they typically are already in production. They've been selling their first product at some level. So we're not deeply involved in the company formation or, you know, the pre-product stages of the company. But once they're about to go into market, we could be super helpful about helping them craft their story. Sometimes pricing is something we can assist with very easily if it's not been established yet. But let's just assume the product's in market. The hardest thing is getting an audience. It's just super hard to break through in a crowded world. And quite often these companies only have one product. So retailers aren't very interested quite yet in a single product company. And it's expensive to crack through on social media. It's a very sophisticated activity.
Oh yeah.
So they're kind of like, what do I do? Basically, maybe they finish a crowdfunding campaign where it was super exciting and they did get a lot of attention. And then it's crickets. And we quite often meet a company in the crickets phase. And we're trying to basically cut a couple years of pain and suffering out of their lives of trying to find an audience, because we can take them right to a big audience quickly. And if it goes well, or if they're interested in scaling, we also introduced a wholesale side of our business a few years ago. So we have 6,000 retailers who are customers. So we solved that problem of retailers not liking to engage with a single product company. It's just administratively, legally, operationally difficult for them. And they can have access to, say, 1,500 different companies by with a single account with the Grommet. So we make things safer and more efficient for retailers, both on, like, is this product any good? Because if it comes from the Grommet, it is. And secondly, the order processing and supply chain sides, we make a lot easier for retailers.
Yeah. On that note, I mean, there's a lot of chatter in the marketplace, or in the investment world, I should say, and sort of among retailers about marketplaces. You're, you know, in an early marketplace. You've been around for 11 years. You've been through a lot. I feel like you've got an interesting twist to your marketplace, in that it's almost beyond curation. Like, you've definitely got the curation aspect. You're looking at hundreds of products and only going to market with six. But it also kind of feels like you're a bit of an incubator for those brands to some degree. Maybe talk to us a little bit about how you're differentiating yourself, but also challenges that marketplaces face today, especially given just the hype. There's so much hype around marketplaces right now.
Well, there's hype around marketplaces as a business model. Is that what you're referring to, Brian? Is that what you
mean? Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. And they are magical business models that are super hard to get started because of the chicken and egg thing, right? But I do see, and I believe there's a trend in retail to move increasingly to marketplaces, but they'll be increasingly more niche. You know, let me just sort of paint a picture of how I see marketplaces playing out. If you think of sort of ease of shopping and sort of quality and originality of product, Etsy would be at the kind of low end of ease of shopping, but really high on originality of product, special, quite often custom. And then at the polar opposite would be Amazon, is another large marketplace for no originality of product. That's not what you go there for. You go there when you know what you want. You're not browsing and discovering. It's commodity for the most part. So low on originality, but very high in ease of shopping. Well, there's a whole world of consumer life in between there. Etsy just bought Reverb, the musical instrument marketplace.
Yep.
So that's what I mean by niche marketplace. We see that, you know, with StockX and sneakers. We see that with The RealReal, with resale of designer merchandise. So there are a lot of interesting scalable. I don't mean small when I say niche. I just mean more focused than either Etsy or Amazon could be. And I see the Grommet is playing in that space as well. And honestly, this is a little more future talk, but I feel an imperative to broaden our footprint to address the volume of products we're not getting to right now, because we're rejecting, you know, a lot of awfully good products every week because we don't have a classic marketplace presentation. So we'll be doing some work on that, actually, to help say the 25 a week that we can't get to, that we can get to them. So that's kind of a news flash or a future flash for the Grommet. But I think marketplaces are really, really powerful and really special. But for us, and for the ones that I think will succeed in what I call that niche space, they have to know who they are, and they have to preserve quality in whatever it is they're doing. You know, The RealReal would be verifying the quality of the products. Reverb, you know, isn't probably selling, you know, counterfeit products, which would be right on Amazon. They're saying, no, you come here, you can trust us for your, you know, your interest here, the products that we sell that serve your interest. And the Grommet has that same, you know, kind of at the extreme reputation and reality of assuring quality. So the trick is to not lose who you are. Like the first funder of eBay actually told me that I would have this challenge right before we started the business. Bob Cagle at Benchmark was their venture capitalist. And he said, Jules, you're going to have the challenge of growing big while staying small. And The staying small part to me means A, always being able to meet these small companies where they are. They don't have warehouses full of product that you can just pound them with volume. But also it means being willing to take the risk on those products and deal with them in the early days. And it means small, this word doesn't really translate perfectly for what I want to say, but keeping our eye on the ball of who brought us to the party and why they're here. Like, people do want to be able to trust our products for the quality and that they're the truth of what their promises are. So even as we expand some of how we present products or access products, we can't lose sight of that, because that's why people care, you know, are here. To quantify that, our return rate when people buy a product here is under 3%. You will not hear that number from any e-commerce site that I'm aware of. You know, teens to 20s are typical. And the reason why ours is so low, like confoundingly low, is two. One, video actually helps a lot to head off returns. Like, we don't want you to buy something if it's not what you expected. And photos can be more difficult to navigate. Videos kind of cut to the chase and create product understanding so that you won't buy things that you need to return. But the bigger reason is we just don't present things that aren't worth your money. You know, it's so weird to win on quality and trust, because you would think that would be something everyone wants to do. But marketplaces are usually antithetical to that. They might be good at, like, Amazon's great on the operational trust, but product trust, there's zero trust. They don't represent that these products are safe or authentic. Yes. It's not their promise.
Future Commerce is brought to you by Vertex. Vertex provides cloud and on-premise solutions that can be tailored to specific industries for every major line of tax, including sales and use, income, value added, and payroll. Vertex Cloud is the SaaS solution that automates sales and use tax, including calculation and returns. With multiple service levels and flexible pricing models, Vertex Cloud meets the sales and use tax needs for businesses of all sizes. From recognizable brands like Honda, Pepsi, Verizon, and small businesses the world over. Find out more today at vertexsmb.com and be sure to mention Future Commerce Podcast to get 15 months for the price of 12. Once again, that's vertexsmb.com. Future Commerce is brought to you by Gladly. For today's discerning customers, customer service has become the new marketing. The world's most customer-centric brands are realizing that great personalized experiences are the difference between thriving and dying. And that's why Gladly built a customer service platform that puts people at the center, not tickets or cases. By focusing on the customer, Gladly helps power a lifetime of naturally productive conversations across any channel, from phone, email, text, chat, and social media. Gladly helps companies better understand who their customers are, like what did they last reach out about, and whether or not they're more particular to kicking it in a pair of high tops or wingtips. With key customer context at their fingertips, companies can meet their customers where they are, and they're empowered to build the kinds of relationships that drive long-term loyalty and long-term revenue. It's tough to try to build a customer experience for the next 50 years using the technology of the past 50 years. See what a truly customer-centered platform looks like at gladly.com/FC demo. That's gladly.com/FC, as in Future Commerce, demo. Future Commerce is brought to you by Klaviyo. What do sophisticated direct-to-consumer brands like ColourPop, Huckberry, and Custom Ink all have in common? Well, they're all powered by Klaviyo. Klaviyo is the growth marketing platform that is trusted by over 20,000 online businesses. They have a dedicated team of experts and a platform that consumes more data than any other on the market. And Klaviyo can help you own the customer experience to grow higher value relationships. From a shopper's first impression to each subsequent purchase, Klaviyo understands every interaction and empowers brands to create more personalized marketing moments. When you have a 360-degree view of the customer, the growth possibilities are endless. I want you to check them out today by visiting klaviyo.com/futurecommerce to learn more. Once again, that's klaviyo.com/futurecommerce.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. I think you nailed it actually, that you know, marketplaces that all the marketplaces that I shop on, I shouldn't say all, a lot of the marketplaces that I shop on, it's not really about, you're not trusted. Like I don't trust the quality in most of these marketplaces that I go to. And that should be the reason you're there. That's amazing.
You're banking on like, all right, I'm taking some product risk here, but I'm going to go for the convenience and a fair price. But I would say that mix is rapidly changing right now in that, there was a big expose in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago about the, this is just about Amazon, but there's no vetting of, say, a product that you ingest or a product that you plug into your wall or use on your pet or with your child. Like, they're all the same to Amazon. And so there is a huge quantity of listings that are, you know, substances that are banned by the FDA in the US, or lead paint in toys. And it's whack-a-mole for Amazon to try to do anything about that, mainly because 40% of the listings on Amazon now come straight from Chinese factories. So the Chinese factories are really the bad players there. They don't, you know, Amazon doesn't have the same vetting that even a Target or a Walmart would have.
That's it's interesting. You mentioned a litany of marketplaces earlier. I happen to shop at all of those marketplaces, which I don't know if you're just, you know, looking at my phone and seeing all the apps I have installed. I find it interesting that one of your, it's funny. I have this theory that everybody has a superpower. And I think, you know, yours, you've sort of gone into a little bit. The grommet seems to sort of thrive on the superpower of an entrepreneur. And you know, the wealth of entrepreneurs that we have in the United States, despite what some people might put out on Twitter with a graph that shows it going, you know, down and to the right. And I'd love your take on that too. But entrepreneurship is what's driving your business. I had this thought recently that, you know, there's sort of this, in reading this book, called How to Do Nothing, by Jenny Odell. Talks about resisting the attention economy and how, you know, labor unions in the 20s, you know, labor, it was a right to be a worker, and that being an entrepreneur was an incredible amount of risk that nobody in their right mind would take. But now we sort of romanticize entrepreneurship, and, you know, companies like yours seem to exist on the fact that we have a fascination around American entrepreneurship. Do you think that that's a truth? Do you think that that's something that exists in the world right now, or at least in the American consumer mindset, that they're supporting entrepreneurship by supporting the grommet?
That's such a great question. So statistically, there's absolute truth to what you're saying outside of the grommet. 66% of millennials say they want to start their own business, and 75% of high school students say that. So, and especially at the high school level, that's like pure romanticism, right? These kids don't know anything yet, but they're saying that instead of playing baseball or being a rock star, right? They want to be an entrepreneur. So that's definitely proof of romanticism to me. But I do believe there is, at least in our neck of the woods, this really healthy ecosystem forming around the type of entrepreneurs we work with, because they have to be, once they get the product to market, they have to be good at a whole lot of things. And a lot of the things that used to be locked up inside of a big company are now available to these companies. So, you know, the internet's their biggest friend. They can use YouTube to figure out most anything, but like, say, to find a factory, to find a designer, find an engineer, figure out how to do packaging, how to do market research, how to ship effectively, you know, at Amazon levels of service, but at very low volumes. There are businesses, you know, standing around them, Shopify, to put up a good website, payment system. So I think what's interesting is that it's not just that there's an explosion of, you know, and again, I'm a hammer, everything's a nail. I look a lot at product innovation and product entrepreneurship, but it's not just an explosion of those companies, because they couldn't make it unless there was a concurrent explosion of services and platforms standing up to actually help them. So it's happening on so many different levels, where the ones that you might think of as more like obviously heroic are the type we work with, like sell a product you can relate to. But somebody who stands up, you know, a great customer yep. service platform for these companies is just as valuable in the economy.
Yes. Emphatically. Yes. You look back, there's a aphorism that is escaping me at the moment. There's a, in the gold rush, right? Like you want to be in the pickaxe business, right? And that's really what it is. Cause yes. even people that never find yeah. gold still need the tool. And that's, gosh, that's yes. such an astute point.
Here's the thing that's happening too. Like, you know, entrepreneurs need to be inspired by seeing a market opportunity, and all of us, like in our social feeds, are seeing, I call them the Instagram brands or the upstart brands,
yep.
are seeing like, whoa, these companies must need help. They've got really cool products, but maybe I can do something in this ecosystem. And I would definitely give tons of props to Kickstarter and Indiegogo for the same thing, that the crowdfunding platforms also sort of woke up a lot of latent entrepreneurs. Like, maybe I don't want to make a new set of headphones, but I would like to help that company ship those headphones.
Yeah. I also see those platforms as sort of testing out the theory that a product has the right to exist in the marketplace. Sort of the, is smart luggage a category that deserves to exist, or is the cachet actually wrapped up in the brand of a way, mm-hmm. right? Is a battery built into a suitcase, you know, a category that consumers need, or is it the brand that resonates? And I find that crowdfunding tends to suss out those things better than just, you know, watching winners and losers in the marketplace. But that's my own.
Yeah, it's super helpful for a proportionate read. I would say that there's a much broader customer set for those products beyond what you would find on the crowdfunding platforms. They tend to be older males with high disposable income. And the powerhouse consumer in the economy is similar, but female. So they don't attract the full panoply of consumers, but I still think we find them to be a useful indicator. It's not an entire read, but they're a useful indicator. But then there's a whole world of opportunity beyond those. But when you mention a company like Away, then my mind goes right to something else, which is, it's not actually necessarily, my experience is that it's these products in the direct-to-consumer realm tend to be just good enough. Like I wouldn't claim from my experience of them that they are head and shoulders better than competition, but their experience of buying them and interacting with the company is head and shoulders above whatever alternative they're competing with, you know. And the big ones are mattresses and, you know, shaving and eyeglasses and Away. But these are really brilliant entrepreneurs for understanding like everything that goes into a purchase decision and an experience with a brand. So I get a little annoyed with them when they claim, this is my little axe I'm going to tell you, I don't like their messages around cut out the middleman, you'll get a better product if you don't go to a retailer. That is such a lie, because, you know, digital rent is Google and Facebook. How do these companies find you? You don't find them. They find you on your platforms. And, you know, they're paying the same amount of margin to Facebook that they would pay to Macy's. No different.
Wow. I love that. That's not a take you hear. That's a great hot take. You get into a little bit of an echo chamber in certain circles. There seems to be a lot of back padding. I love that perspective. Do you have any other hot takes in your new book, How We Make Stuff Now? Tell us a little bit about the book and what inspired you to write it.
So it was probably the slowest book ever written, because it took, you know, 10 years of running the business to have the right to write it and to have the knowledge to write it. Because frankly, I wrote it for three reasons. One, I feel like these entrepreneurs tend to operate in isolation. They're, in our experience, only 10% of our makers have any experience in creating a product. They're dentists or teachers. And so they're operating in a kind of, you know, isolated or even a little bit lonely space. So I wanted to put all the things that I learned from them in one place and give them both a roadmap for creating a product in the future, like the new person who shows up. But also for the existing makers we work with, it's a very snackable book. There are 16 different competencies I describe for successfully building a consumer product business. And it's a book that for existing makers, not just the new ones, they could just dive in and out of the chapters where they have a current issue. They don't have to read the book cover to cover. And the third reason I wrote it is I just love to write. And it was kind of like a low priority bucket list item for me. It wasn't top of my list, but when I realized I almost had like a economic or social responsibility to get this information out, because there isn't a book like this. You know, this is why the book was picked up by McGraw-Hill. Like, there's no competition essentially. And if there had been, I wouldn't have written it. If I thought there was a credible book out there, I don't like doing me too things. My business is original. My life is original. Right. Bought into personal stuff, you would hear I don't make decisions like other people around my own life sometimes. So I wouldn't have written a copycat book.
You said it's distilled down into sort of 16 bite-sized pieces. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of what each of those might be?
Yeah. So like, you know, how do I know if my idea is a good one? And how do I get educated and build a network to succeed in my business, because that becomes the number one business skill for these folks. And they don't see that coming when they start the business, but it's a big differentiator for successful entrepreneurs. I would say tenacity and the ability to create a network are going to be two of the biggest success points for them. How do I design a product and engineer a product? How do I think about having an e-commerce website and payments? How do I think about packaging? Logistics? How do I think about marketing? So essentially, I contend that these folks are, by hook or by crook, in our world, it's table stakes that they have a better product. Like, they probably will go nowhere if they don't have a better product. But once they're into the market, then they're competing on these 16 competencies or many of these competencies with big guys who do have an advantage. And I want to kind of remove some of that advantage and tell them the inside scoop about, well, here's how this works.
I haven't read the book, I'll just be honest, but I'm going to have to now, because this is something that's really top of mind for me, you know, as we build out Future Commerce. Is, you know, we're one of the very few, sort of like bootstrapped media startups, in, at least in North America, and specifically focusing on an area of retail reporting. So, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot right now is this access to capital. Is there anything in the book around how founders are accessing capital now that, you know, can help them stand toe to toe with, you know, larger organizations? What kind of advice do you give to founders who feel the pressure around, you know, just obtaining capital for their company?
Yeah, I would say the two areas of the book or this maker journey that are hardest are creating and protecting your intellectual property. So that's separate than capital, but it's a big hot button area. And then financing their businesses. And frankly, when we started, crowdfunding didn't exist. So it was infinitely harder before. They are the gift that keeps on giving. So I'm not saying something that you haven't thought of and your listeners haven't thought of, but I can't emphasize enough how important this source of capital is. And it's now a situation where we see our makers running dual campaigns on Kickstarter and Indiegogo. And Indiegogo has a feature where you can kind of basically just keep your company alive, almost as like a shop, your campaign alive. So they're getting more nuanced too, and how those platforms operate. Beyond that, one of the advantages these companies have is that you can finance inventory in a different way from equity. Like, you know, you're probably thinking equity financing generally. And when you have, you know, defined purchase orders, you can actually get those purchase orders financed. There's a company I mentioned in the book called Now Account. And so let's say success can almost kill you. You get a big order from Whole Foods or even from the Gromit, and then suddenly you're responsible on the hook for tens of thousands of units. You can take that purchase order and get it bought by Now Account for 3%, which is a very different proposition than 10 or 20 years ago, where the only option for these companies was factoring, which had very usurious, the same sort of thing. You would go sell a purchase order, would cost you double digits, and now it's only 3%. Wow. So, you know, that probably is the second biggest change in financing these companies.
So it's beyond just trading, you know, equity for capital. It's taking your established proof of being able to, you know, actually sell and make products and use that as, you know, that sounds more like a long-term sort of traditional sustainable way of running a profitable business.
Yes, it is. And it's healthier. And frankly, it's partly a response to the fact that it is hard to get equity capital for these companies. The you know, when you look at sort of the angel level funding, that's not impossible, but you know, the exits for these companies and the scalabilities of these companies are not always obvious. It depends. You know, I will say that in consumer packaged goods, so health and beauty and food, the exits are very plentiful. This is the heyday of small company exits to large brands. You know, people are saying M&A is the new R&D, but it's less common, say, in tech, gadgets, tools, kitchen. Those paths are usually not as obvious to people, that literally those transactions tend to happen a little more under the radar, where our company, say a toy company, will get bought by a medium-sized or bigger toy company, but doesn't really make the news. And so, and the angel investor base isn't as aware of the possible exits. And VCs are dabbling in this area, I would say, but they're not, it's not their bread and butter, because they don't know how to evaluate these companies. They're way more open than they used to be, because, you know, when Amazon bought Ring and Google bought Nest, you know, there are some pretty cool things happening even in products. But it's still a hard area for venture capitalists. Oh, one other source I should mention, though, this is more for primarily the consumer packaged goods companies, but Circle Up is a good financing source for those folks. They do some products that are not CPG as well. A number of grommets have gotten financing through Circle Up. It's a platform that basically aggregates angel investors, and it is equity funding. But they prove out some of these companies before they introduce them to their network. So it's a vetted and it's kind of curated offering to the network. So that's been a very good source of funding for some of our companies.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I spent some time with I don't know if he's infamous. I'll say infamous. I spent some time with Jason Calacanis earlier this year. And, you know, he's really invested in his syndicate and sort of the way that they're approaching ideas and founding entrepreneurship. And that sort of world of syndicates and angels and people sort of doing more passive entrepreneurship investment seems like a really interesting way, like a new way for companies to be able to, you know, bring businesses to market that otherwise, you know, probably were at the mercy of whatever their local bank, you know, was willing to to fund. And you know, if they, it just seems like you now is such a magical time as an entrepreneur to try to build a business, because there are so many options available to you.
Yes, it definitely is. In fact, I've kind of jumped on that bandwagon. I became an investing partner at X Factor Ventures, and its particular focus is diverse founding teams. In particular, there needs to be somebody who's female on the founding team. So, you know, we're trying to correct some of the imbalance in funding to women. I see a huge competitive advantage in going after to these diverse teams that. Women CEOs get less than 3% of venture capital funding. So, you know, to me, it's a pure, you know, well, it's not pure. It's a social good, but it's more so a business decision. You know, like this is great business to do this.
How awesome is that? Man, this has been so good and so rewarding. I've bummed out that we're a little bit out of time here. Any closing thoughts? You know, we usually ask our guests to sort of predict the future. I feel like that's day passe now. We're getting copied everywhere. If you had to give some some of our listeners clear advice, what's in your head right now? What's something that you're thinking about and resonating with you that you might be able to deliver succinctly to someone who might be listening that's facing some challenges right now?
Well, one of the things when we started this business, people worried we'd run out of good ideas. And I was pretty confident we wouldn't. We were betting on human creativity. Mm-hmm. But what people probably wouldn't have any way to know is every single week, the top of my head's blown off by some innovation that comes through our doors. And usually more than once a week, this happens. I mean, truly just astonishes me. And what I would like people to know is if you have an idea and you sort of look around and you see absolutely nobody working on it, it might feel discouraging, but I would just press pause for a minute and say, my experience has been sometimes the world just waiting for you to work on that idea. So press pause and think about it that way, as opposed to getting discouraged because there's no proof that this is an interesting area.
What great advice. I wish we heard that from more people. it's such a bleak world out there at times. And so having encouragement like that, I think it's exactly what everyone needs to hear right now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Jules. It's been great to have you, to learn from all of your experiences and gain a little bit of wisdom. I love it. Well, and thank you to our audience for listening. We love that you're tuning in every week, and we would love to hear your feedback on today's show. Tell us more about your experiences building brands or marketplaces or launching products. And you can leave us feedback on our site, futurecommerce.fm, or anywhere that you can engage with us, social media, and Twitter, LinkedIn, all of the above. And of course, we always love to get your a 5-star from you on iTunes. So hop on over there and leave us a 5-star if you enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening. No longer are we just focused on technology. Mm. We are focused on so much more. Philip, do you want to take us home?
The future of commerce is what you make it.
And we help you shape that future. Thanks for listening.
The audio version of our show is produced by Chris Harry at Pod Sherpa. Show notes are written by Jordan Griffey and Leanne Heikend. Scheduling and coordination are provided by Aaron DeCruz. Our intro music is composed and performed by Spectral Wolf. Future Commerce is a production of Protein Commerce, LLC.